You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is another episode recorded live at Bob and Misbehave's Bookshop at the Edinburgh Fringe 2014. This is the devastatingly funny Bridget Christie. Bridget, how is your show? How are you? How's it going? I haven't seen you properly in ages. The last time you and I had a proper chat was 2 years ago when we gigged together at We Love Comedy in Liverpool Street. And it was about 2 weeks before the Edinburgh Festival. And you were backstage and you went, Stuart, I've got nothing. I've got nothing. And then, sorry, 1 year ago, because that was the year you came up and then smashed it and won the award.
Well,
2 weeks later.
Well, I don't think I smashed it. But yeah, I think I had a bit of the show, didn't I? I didn't have all the ending, but I think I had.
Not according to you. You were like, I've got nothing. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm breaking it.
Yeah, I do normally leave it. Like, I don't leave it late. I normally start writing them around sort of May.
Okay. It's kind of late.
Yeah, but. The world changes quick. I normally have like a few routines that, like, I could use, but then I'm going to do the whole hour like this. I've normally got about 15 minutes, okay. But then just from May, hammer it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So where
stuff happens, things change.
Yes. And at least that way you get to be really current if you're writing the bulk of the show just before coming up here.
Well, not just before, a couple of months before.
I speak as someone who starts writing in October to try and get it done so I can have as many possible stabs at it as I can.
I have thoughts all the time. Like, I think a lot. Like, owls, they think a lot, don't they?
Tell you what.
They do, don't they? Don't they? I think they do, don't they? There's a book about it. I've read it. It says all owls think a lot. Yeah. If you don't believe me,
How are you with the show this year?
All right. It was not. I had to redo the ending, sort of pretty much on the way up here.
Okay.
Because I got an email from the Department for Education on. I thought, oh, that's relevant to a bit in the show, so I should probably try and work that in, but I didn't know how really to work it in. And also, even though I'd done a lot of previews, I hadn't properly worked out the structure of the last sort of 15, 20 minutes of it until really late, like end of July, late. And so I hadn't learned it. But if I got the order wrong, the whole thing would fall apart. And it occurred to me in the first week that if something spontaneous happened in the room, I'd have to go all the way back to the beginning. Of the, you know, like when you're praying and you forget and you go, oh, Father who art in heaven.
Do you have to go back to the beginning again? In order to remember it, you need to get the structure.
Yeah, exactly. I'd have to go right back to the, you know, I was hoping, but not many people heckle at 11 o'clock in the morning. So it was all right.
Yes, okay. And are you enjoying it this year?
I did forget. I did have a complete blank in the first week. I had no idea where I was or what was coming next. I had to pretend that I was thinking. So I went, oh, that, yes, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yes. Oh, anyway, and I don't think they noticed.
Did you get away with it?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, no, I don't think. And you can do it. I can't do that now because this is, people can't see my face, can they, when they listen to this back?
No, but I can commentate.
Explain what I do with my face. Yeah, no. But I know the show now, so I'm all right. I'm enjoying it a bit more.
Okay. And is it, do you feel with this show you've set out what you've done what you set out to do? Are you satisfied with the show that it's a complete? I'm not, I feel like I'm implying it isn't finished. I don't mean that at all. But I'm just trying to get a sense of how happy you are. Are you like, yep, this one, done it?
No, I'm never happy with anything I do. Like, I never think, oh, yes, oh, yes. I always think there's room for improvement. Because okay. Then you tour it and then it just gets better. The shows always evolve. They always get better the more you do them, unless something's gone really wrong.
So in the life of this show, this is a springboard into the tour.
Oh, I mean, by May, this show's going to be great. Next May.
And I think David Trent told me that you're planning now, from now on, to tour both shows together, last year's and this year's.
Yeah, so the tour will be a bit for her, edited down a little bit, so that'll be about 45 minutes, and there'll be an interval, and then there'll be this one.
Okay.
So if you don't like sort of what I do, it was your worst nightmare. Just 2 hours of ranting.
So let's talk about the starting points then for your show. This is your eighth show. Is that right?
Cheese roll. Charles II. Charles II the Second. Daily Mail. Housewife Surrealist. A Ant. War Donkey. Bic for Her. Ungrateful Woman. Tenth. Yeah.
Tenth show. Okay. And of those, I think I saw A Ant and I saw Housewife Surrealist.
Right.
And I've seen the last two.
Okay.
And yeah. I remember in A Ant, you were dressed as an ant on stage in the little room above the stand two.
Yeah.
And you were...
It's a small room to be dressed as an ant in. Yeah, it did occur to me when I thought, I've just got to commit to this now. It's all about context, isn't it? I mean, if you... okay, so if you're in a massive theatre and you come out as an ant, people go, oh, I'm in a big theatre and there's lots of people here. That's obviously a decision and that's fine. There's an ant, let's go for it. If you're in a tiny room and there's no one in there and an ant comes out, it's probably quite intimidating. I would have less because it's not endorsed, is it, by anybody?
Yeah, okay.
It's just an ant who's not doing very well. There might be a reason for that. But so I just had to commit to it, really. And not try and do it less, because the ant was quite an aggressive character. It was basically, well, that was the start of me talking about sort of feminist issues, but I thought, well, people are probably more likely to accept it if it's coming from an ant rather than a woman. So, listen, at that in 2011, whenever it was, feminism was really not at all acceptable in any way, not even in comedy. So I thought, oh, I'll pretend to be, you know, an ant, and I'll do it sort of like that. But then I just didn't dress up as an ant. I'm just now basically the ant without the costume. That's what happened. Just sort of evolved.
It's become more. You realised it would be more accessible maybe if they weren't thinking, why are you an ant?
Do you know what? Honestly, I just couldn't be bothered dressing up anymore.
Because I remember the bit. I remember the ant saying you were doing a bit about how they don't. You never have more than one ant on a bill in a comedy club, and there are special competitions just for ants, just for ant comedians.
Yeah, just for ant. You know, and why do they always have to mention that we're ants in reviews? You know. Oh, it's doing much better here.
Yeah,
than
it is. Yeah.
Like, where were you 4 years ago? Yeah, you fair weather feminist. Yeah. It wasn't. I don't know. You're already in absurd territory. So, but I mean, a lot of people despised it, like they do now, what I do. But I just thought, yeah, that was a sort of critique about women in comedy. But most people got it. Most audiences didn't get it, but most comics got it, and critics.
That was my experience of it at the time. Was I was laughing a lot and feeling a little bit self-conscious
because nobody else was.
A couple of other people were. Yeah,
a couple. Yeah, in that 800-seater, was that?
Yeah,
one?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
No.
So I'm really interested in how you've developed from the absurd stuff that you were doing before to the stuff that you're doing now. But in order to look at that, these are questions you'll have been asked before about your origins, but can you tell us a bit about how you started comedy, how you brought yourself to it?
Yeah, well, I always have had day jobs and things like that. So I went to drama school and then I was an actor for a bit. But you have no control over it if you're sort of... You're just waiting to be picked all the time. And I found that sort of really depressing, and it didn't make me sort of feel good about it. It seemed like I was just wasting my life waiting for people to think that I was all right. And then I thought, well, if I could write something and then say it at night, that seems like quite an amazing thing to be able to do. And also I could keep my day job and pay my rent, stuff like that. So that's really what happened.
What was the impetus to go into acting in the first place? What was it that drew you to that? Were you wanting like for crowds to be into you? What was it?
So it was probably because I'm the youngest of nine children, and
I honestly thought you were going to say ants then. Sorry.
Yes, we're a very small family. And you know, we're very sort of Irish parents, a big sort of part of our a big part of Irish culture is to sort of all sit round and tell stories, and especially ghost stories later on, or just like discuss things and all sit round. And pretty much by the time you've got to the ninth opinion on something, it's, you know, everyone's gone to the toilet. So no one really listened. I think I said when I was about four, that I'd be an actress or something, and then maybe someone would listen. But I don't know. I remember my dad saying that, see, he had some of his mates around once, and I was ignored again, and I was about three or four or something, and I walked. He had all his mates from the factory around, and I walked through the room and just said, oh, if there's one thing I hate, it's being ignored or something like that. But I don't know. I just liked it. Also, I thought, oh, all you have to do really is learn some lines. So I probably won't have to do much work at school. Just learn how to read. And then I could maybe get my own house or something. Just by reading.
That's a very honest appraisal of the desire to be an actor. I was an actor for a little while, and that was sort of my plan. I basically wanted to show off, not have a real job, not have to get up early in the morning, and get money.
Yeah, and get money, not have to really make much of an effort.
Yeah. And so for me,
I never wanted to be famous.
Okay.
That wasn't part of it, or rich. You know, that wasn't.
Just wanted to what then? To be able to.
I liked expressing myself in unusual ways. Like we used to do a lot of plays, me and my brothers and sisters and things like that. And they never would let me speak because they'd always say, no, you'll get the words wrong. So I was always like an object. But I would do that object as well as I could.
Okay.
I'd be like a, a box or a bush or a tree or a coat, and I'd really commit to it. I'd be right, I'm going to be the best coat that's in this play.
Suddenly starting to make sense, some of the things I've seen you do at ACMS, the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society. I'm sure like within the last year or two I saw you being you had a green head with a swimming cap, and you were being
a pea
on a plate.
Yes.
Yeah, and you totally committed to it.
Well, I think you have to, don't you? It can't just be half a pea. Yes, I've decided to be a pea, but I don't really believe in it. No, I think you have. If you don't believe you're a pea, then nobody else will.
Drama training, deeply ingrained.
But what was that about? Pea?
Yeah, I don't
know. Is it something to do with my name? Crispy or something?
It may have been. I don't honestly remember.
No, I think
I've got the... I'm a visual memory
Well, I don't know
person.
Why I'm asking you.
I should
know the answer to that.
Yeah.
There was a good reason. Oh, I remembered what
Go
it
on.
Was. I liked the idea. Okay, it was a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
Could have been, yeah.
Okay, so this was... I liked the... and it didn't... I didn't do it in the end. I liked the idea of... being set up in the room in Edinburgh, because I think I knew I was going to be in the Stand One. It's such a tiny stage there, and the audience coming in, they're really close to you.
Mm.
So I'd already had the venue, but I didn't know what show I was going to do. And the P was, I liked the idea of me being in some kind of seat-like thing where you couldn't see my body, but my head was... there on the top of the thing, so
okay.
Like in sort of a table with a black cloth around it, and my head, which was going to be a pea, would just be on the top, and then there'd just be a spotlight on my face, and I'd be there looking at the audience as they came in.
I mean, when you say it like that...
That's what I was going to do, and then I thought, but... I've got... How do I then get out of... Do I just get out of it and then do a stand-up set? Or, like, how would that... How would I then follow that? I liked the idea of, as an audience are coming in, because it takes 20 minutes or half an hour,
mm-hmm.
of just me being... of just my head being visible, you know, on a plate. Just looking at them as they came in.
So let's look at the. We'll come.
We didn't do it.
We'll return to the.
I might do it next year.
It's tickling this lot. We'll return to the P and some of the more absurd stuff. But you were so when you decided, okay, acting is waiting around. What was the first piece of stand up that you did, and what was the beginning of that process for you?
Would be open. I think it was an open mic gig at the. That massive pub in Clapham, the Alexander, I think. PJ,
yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yes, I remember
Ran
PJ.
Ran a lot of
yep.
gigs. And I
his gigs were called the Comedy Stop because it was one letter above the Comedy Store in the listings. I don't know that for certain, but that's clearly why he did that.
Yeah, I think it was quite traumatic. I don't really remember what I said, what I was... I remember not being able to hear my voice. So I don't know what I was saying.
Had you written a set for it? Were you improvising? Were
no,
you doing
I
stories?
I had some ideas.
Okay.
That I think I talked about.
What do you remember? What sort of what kind of like territory you were in? Was it surreal kind of stuff or?
I think it was a bit of. But I have this story about being at the fair, and this is a long time ago. And thinking that I thought that I'd seen my dad on one of the rides, but actually realising it wasn't my dad, and it was a fridge. I don't think I ever did that again, ever.
Were you... and were you... What? Why? Why that kind of stuff? Like, had you seen other comics at the time? Were you into comedy? Were you watching other comics? And because that sounds like such a different thing to do from most people's first gig. Do you remember it being in opposition to an existing thing?
No, I didn't watch I watched a bit of stand up, but not to see how I would do it. Just I don't think you can do. I think you have to do. What you think you would like to see, maybe, or I don't know. And back then, that is the sort of thing that used to amuse me.
Okay.
So I said, but it didn't. No one else thought it was very amusing. I did another. Someone told me as well that I was doing it all wrong because I used to do a different thing each time rather than try and work out a thing.
Yes, okay, rather than have a set, you were writing new stuff for every single gig.
Yeah, and then not do it ever again. And I think I did that for about 9 years. No, not 9 years, but for a very long time.
Okay, and so what was the first set that you remember putting together, the first time it kind of coalesced into a set?
God. I don't remember, because I used to do... like characters as well. I think I did a bit about the cheese roll. The cheese roll, not a cheese roll, which is like an old ritual in Gloucester where people run down a hill.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but I used to do characters as well and other sorts of things. So I didn't really do stand-up full-time for a really, really long time, for years and years.
Okay.
Oh, and ghosts as well. I think I used to do some ghost stories.
Okay.
So I don't remember a set because there wasn't a set that I used to do a lot. I think I used to do like just bits and bobs all the time.
And were you finding that satisfying? Were you going out and doing... Were you getting the reaction that you wanted to get at that time?
Oh, no.
So were you... Well, I mean, what...
Oh, good God, no.
Were you getting vastly underneath? Were people... kind of half going for it? Were people hating it? What do you remember from that time and what kind of action did you take?
Generally not going for it for a long time.
So how did you manage to keep doing the stuff that you wanted to do in the face of a negative response from an audience?
Well,
from
people that seems very arrogant now looking back at it. To keep doing stuff that nobody likes. It's not like this mad, delusional way. Yes, you're all wrong. No.
Well, that's something. Some people are like that. Sometimes, you know, Sam Simmons, I interviewed Sam Simmons the other week, and he was talking about when he does stuff that he does very absurd stuff, you don't know Sam's work, he was talking about how he gets angry with an audience because he's like, come on, this is funny. Why are you going for it? You know, so, you did keep, you stuck to your guns.
Yeah, but I wouldn't get angry. Like, I think I thought, oh, something's not gelling, but something's not gelling here, clearly. But I didn't think that I should then not do something that I didn't like myself because so that other people would like it.
Okay.
If you know what I mean.
Sure.
But I do remember, okay, so I did one tour where I was still dressing up and doing quite absurd things. And touring is really different from doing sort of circuit gigs because you're out on your own and it's pretty lonely and you're really forced to face yourself and really have a good, long, hard look at what you're doing and why it might not be working. Also, there's no other people on the bill or anything like that, so there's nothing to fall back on. And I did think, I wonder if there's a way of... sort of meeting this halfway of doing what I like, but also giving them, you know, making people have an enjoyable experience as well.
And which show was that you were touring when you were going through that?
It was War Donkey.
Okay. I didn't see that one. What was the... that? Were you in a sumo costume? Is that the...
Oh, only for about a few seconds.
Okay, oh, that's all I've heard about that one. I didn't see that show.
Yeah, I slowly inflated myself in a... it was going to be all about war donkeys, because like, what donkeys are used in wars, like and I thought at the time that they didn't get much publicity for... You know, it was all about horses and stuff like that. And then... so I thought I'd be a war donkey for the whole show.
Okay.
But then I realised that... donkeys don't have a great deal, but sort of there's a lot of women have got quite bad lives as well, so maybe I should talk about women instead of donkeys, because they have quite a hard deal as well. But I'd already called it War Donkey, so I had to keep a bit of War Donkey in. So
okay.
War Donkey...
That was the show when it changed, when during it you went...
Oh, hang on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think donkeys are as important as women. But I think they are important, donkeys, but not, you know. There's much worse stuff happening. Well, no, I mean, donkeys were strapped with explosives. Anyway, so I thought, well, I've got to do a bit of War Donkey. I've still got to, because it's called War Donkey. I can't just not have anything about war donkeys in it. So I kept that bit about 5 minutes at the beginning where I was dressed up as a donkey. But then when I went on tour, there was one gig in particular I did in Hull. And I was dressed as a donkey. And it was in this club, which used to be a strip club. And I was dressed as a donkey, because I kept in the donkey costume for quite a lot. I was doing it. But anyway, this man, they hadn't cleaned it out properly, so there was still stuff from when it was a strip club around. And I was on this stage, and there was about 10 people in there. And then a really drunk man, because the toilets... So the bar was there, and the toilets were on at the side of the stage where I was, and a man walked across the stage with his willy already out, going to the toilet. And I was dressed as a donkey, talking about feminism, and I just thought... I've got to try and find a way to make this work. I can't be in a donkey costume in Hull as a man with his cock out on my stage. So where is this going? You know, really, that was the decision. In fact, I'd sort of thought, I don't want to really keep doing this.
So this is Bridget. She's absolutely fantastic. If you've not seen her stuff, as we mentioned, she's about to go on tour. She's touring both of the last 2 years' shows. That's A Bick for Her and An Ungrateful Woman. All details are at bridgetchristie.co.uk. Please don't miss out on her shows. And I'd love to see both of them together. They're just sensational pieces of work. Moving, warm, very funny, meaningful, and just... one of those shows that of all the shows, you know, when you're making a list of all your stuff you're going to go and see at the Edinburgh Festival, she's just one of those people that is squarely in the category of, oh God, I can't wait for that one. So yes, one of the very few shows in which I did not look at my watch at all. And those of you who know me will know, I mean, I'm not making any claims as to having ADD, but I will check my watch about 28 minutes into anyone's show. Not hers, though. She's fantastic and completely gripping from the off. So look forward to those. BridgetChristie.co.uk for all her tour details throughout September, October and November, I believe. I'm not going to talk to you much now. I know I often say that, but I'm really not, not least because it's late at night. And I know I can only apologise that you're getting this on Thursday or Friday, and rather, and not the Wednesday that you're supposed to be getting it on. I'm trying to stick to those rules for myself. But, you know, come on, I'm still decompressing. Give me a break. So all I'm going to talk to you about now is two things. One is on the 22nd of September, Tom Stade is going to be my guest at a special live show in Wolverhampton at the Arena Theatre. Tom is going to do a set, and then I'm going to talk to him all about what he's just done. Very much like we did with the James Acaster and Gary Delaney episodes. Tom is incredible. If you've not seen Tom's work before, he's just an absolute born comedian. Very, very funny guy. That should be massive. And it's only a fiver. All details for that, you can buy tickets at the Arena Theatre Wolverhampton website. And also there's a ticket link up on the Twitter feed at ComComPod and on the Facebook page, which you can feel free to join. And as a little extra treat for Facebook page people to say thank you for all your comments and so forth during the festival, you can get a sneak peek if you join up there at the Phil Kay episode, which I'm going to save for release as episode 100 sometime in mid-November, I think. I'm going to give you a little peek at that now just to say thank you. So hurry along there and join the Facebook page and you can get a quick streamable only. You can't download it and please don't share it. Just for your ears only, a little advance episode. The whole thing, unedited, with all the libelous bits still in it. Just such a wonderful interview with Phil Kay. So those things, 22nd of September in Wolverhampton with Tom Stade. Looking forward to seeing a lot of you at that. I would imagine it's a small venue in the arena, and there's every chance it'll sell out. Who knows? The Edinburgh one sold really well. Get in. It's kicking off, guys. It's bloody working. So jump on the website and book a ticket for that. Yes, the Phil Kay one available on the Facebook page. I've also sent that link out to anyone that donated over the last couple of months as a little thank you. So that is all for now. Let's get stuck back into the brilliant Bridget Christie. When War Donkey was touring, what sort of size venues were you playing? Were you getting enough of an audience that that was that like a successful tour for
you?
No.
Not in any way. It's really depressing.
Okay, so what stopped you giving up?
Okay, so somebody came to see that show and they liked a bit in it. and it was Alison Vernon Smith, and then she commissioned a radio series.
Okay.
So I thought I'll do that, and then I'll stop for a little bit. But then someone said, well, it would be mad to do 9 or 8 shows in a row with nobody came to see me in Edinburgh. Was making a loss. Maybe like 20, you know, there was people sort of had start, would slowly, you know, but not never more than 30 people, really, probably 30, 40 people. So I thought, well, I should probably see if the radio thing has made any difference. Mm-hmm. So I'll do this one and then duck out for a little bit, not forever, but not keep coming back every year. But also, because I was thinking of stopping for a little bit, that sort of liberated me from the need to be liked. So I just did a show that I thought didn't really matter, and that was last year's show.
Okay, so the show last year, the one that kind of, I mean, I'm almost going to use the phrase, catapulted you to success, you know, but that made a big difference, that show.
Yeah, but it was the only one that I didn't really, not care about. I did work hard, you know, I did write it and work quite hard, but it was the only show that I didn't really care what people thought about. Mm-hmm. Not audiences. I didn't, so in 2011, feminism was really unpopular. A few of us, there's been female comics doing feminism for years, like Kate Smurthwaite, Danielle Ward did a show that year. We all got really quite critical. Me and Danielle got some, you know, I got a load of 2-star reviews saying, oh, it's such a shame, it's not very good, because, you know, it's about feminism and all of that. And then, so I thought, well, if you didn't.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like that one. You're really not going to like this one. I just sort of really went for it.
And do you think there is a connection between the fact that you didn't care anymore, and that, or not care, but do you know what I mean, that experience you're talking about, and the fact that that was the one that really took off?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I really do. Yeah, because I thought differently about everything.
So when you started writing that show, with from the starting point of, I don't care, I'm just going to do what I want.
Yes.
So what were your starting points? Obviously, well, what was the bic for her that then became the title and a sort of key section of the show? Was that the starting point for that? What were the things that were on that first bit of paper for that
show?
Yeah,
well, the pen bit was about a 5-6 minute routine that was in the radio thing.
Okay.
And I thought about the image of a pen with my head on the top of it. So that was...
Very popular with someone in the back there. I'm sort of assuming that everyone here and listening to this will have heard of that show and what it's about, but if they haven't, could you just give us a quick...
Yeah. So there was just some... I was in Ryman's and I saw these pens that were just for women, and they went in the middle, and they had like a rubbery grip and stuff like that. And I couldn't believe it. And I went up to the woman and I said, I think she was Scandinavian, I said, look at these pens. They're for women. It's just for us. How have they been selling? She went, well, we think they are stupid. And she was in rhymes. I said, yeah, they are, aren't they? They're for her. And then sort of thought about this, the Brontes and all women who've been writing through history. So that routine. And then so that's why I called it that. Then that routine was about 7 minutes in the Edinburgh show. And then all the other stuff came from that, really.
And just to look at that routine then, if that had been in the radio show, what did that look like? What's the experience of you in the room writing that? Are you writing on a laptop? Are you making notes? Are you pacing around?
No, just a laptop.
Okay. Yeah. And when you kind of had the premise of, okay, there's this ludicrous idea of a pen for women and the Bronte sisters, How do you apply yourself to that to try and find funny things in it?
Well, also a big part of like the pen thing is obviously like I'm not that interested in gendered products. Like I'm interested in the sort of much more important issues, but because it's comedy, you have to have these quite banal things to try and distract people from the other stuff that you're going to try and sneak in. Mm-hmm. So something like I'm obviously not interested in pens really, but I knew that I wanted to talk about other stuff as well. So those bits I try and make as silly as possible.
Okay.
So that they make the other bits a bit easier to listen to.
Okay. So in the example of that bit, when you say you're trying to make it silly as possible, that's something I definitely recognise in your shows. There'll be a serious point and then some really silly, absurd stuff. And you do that. You do quite a good job of sort of sending yourself up as well. You do a kind of a caricature of a kind of version of yourself.
Yeah, an exaggerated version.
Yeah.
I think if you're... it's really important to me that I don't look like I'm sort of worthy or important, because we're clowns, aren't we? We're comedians. We're supposed to be... we're not supposed to be... I don't feel that I should be sort of at that high status character, and I should be... Part of it is me working stuff out as well, being mm-hmm. this exaggerated character who gets angry about these things that aren't really that... I'm not really angry about those sure. things. I'm angry about the other things, but it's much easier to laugh at someone who's in a rage about, like, a lolly or a pen or something, rather than looking at someone who's really angry about something that they should be angry about. That's just a bit uncomfortable to watch.
Okay. And is that knowledge, is that born of just... That just makes sense to you, or is that from having tried stuff in the past where you were getting actually angry? Do you see what I mean? Well, how did you happen upon that? Is that just like from the first time you approached
No, just those from kind of thinking subjects? Of it. I don't want... I mean, I don't want to... I'm trying to distract people from the serious things. So if you're... So now that I don't dress up anymore, now that I'm not an ant or a dead king, I have to do that in another way. And another way is by making myself ridiculous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you're marrying those things together, what does the editing process look like? Did you have stuff for last year's show or for this show that you didn't include, that it wasn't working, or can you give us an example of something you might have cut out so we can get an insight into how it looks like when you're assembling the stuff?
Yeah, so there'll be things that I want to talk about, and I'll be thinking about those things in maybe sort of October, November. So like, these are the things I really want to try and talk about. Then I'll sort of think about them and think about them. And then I'll think, well, how can I talk about those things? So I often start at the end of a show and work backwards okay. from there. So the things that I really want to talk about, I will try and put much later on in the show, like about 40 minutes, 45 minutes in, so that they've got to know. Like, there's stuff that I would do in an hour that I would never, ever, ever do in a set.
Okay.
And in fact, what's happened in the last couple of years is that I'm always dying now when I'm on a bill.
Okay.
Like, more often than not.
Okay, because you're talking about stuff you want to talk about and it doesn't seem appropriate in a kind of...
It doesn't work in short sets or out of context.
Okay.
Unless I really, like, think about, oh, that could be a 10-minute bit or a 20... But those are the bits that I'm not... that emotionally connected to. So in terms of an hour show then, so I'll think, right, I want to talk about that and that. How do I lead up to that, or how can I hide that? In A Bit for Her, it wasn't really as structured. It was pretty much one routine followed on from another. Mm-hmm. There was nothing really very serious until right at the end, which was about Malala. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of it was, oh, pens, silly sportsmen, attitudes towards women and feminism, but nothing really quite horrific that needed to be hidden mm-hmm. within. So with this one, I wanted to talk about female genital mutilation and something that I read in The Guardian, which was anti-rape pants. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know if I would be able to, so I spent the sort of a whole year trying to figure out how I might be able to do those, talk about those things, but talk around them, not talk about. And so certain things happened, and then And all the first half hour of the show then came from working at the end of the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you, something you said during the show, this year's show, is you were talking about Steve Davis. And yeah. You refer to a comment he made about women not having the I don't remember the phrase.
The mental focus to be able to push a ball into a hole using a stick. He didn't yes. say that, I said that. He said yeah. play snooker, which is, that is what snooker is.
Yeah. And then you, what I thought was very funny was that you said, he also said a lot of other nice stuff, but that doesn't fit into the narrative I'm trying to make.
Well, not a lot of nice stuff.
No, okay.
He just said they've got better things to do with their time than spend 9 hours a day practicing it, and perhaps that's the real reason why they weren't very good at it. But he still said that we weren't very good at it. But yeah, it's just taking the curse off it a lot, if you know what I mean. It's still comedy. I've got to remember, it's got to be funny first. That's the most important thing. They've got to be laughing. Sorry, you've not been laughing very much. And it's got to be funny first. That's always my, how can I make a joke out of this?
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're putting the material together, are you researching, once you've got the bit between your teeth, do you then presumably research around the subject? Like at one point you mentioned a 4,000-page report that then had a, particular...
One sentence in it.
Yeah, one yeah. sentence in it. So yeah, did yeah. you, I just wondered at the time, did you read the entire report in order to find that?
No, that was that. This went just absolutely insane. The abuse that Rashida Manjoo had when she came here and published that report is that one line. And the her predecessor, the last time she came here and wrote a report, she also was the subject of an inordinate amount of abuse by the British media as well, and press and men. So it was that one sentence taken out of context, and just. She was just, it was just incredible, yeah. But, everything that I say has been really carefully sort of thought about and researched, because, something might happen in the room. You need to have quite a robust argument. It needs to make sense. Needs to make sense as well.
In order that you can be silly about it as well. Presumably, yeah. you need to know exactly what the point is that you're arguing, so that you can then take it out of it.
Exactly.
So, do you have a favourite bit to perform in terms of like the pleasure of performing and getting laughs from people? Do you have a favourite bit from this year's show?
No, no, not. Favourite bit. I like the end routine where I'm talking about a yogurt advert audition, but I keep coming out of it to talk about different things and then getting back into it. I like it when I get back into it.
Okay.
So I like it when I end the thing that I like deviating from the thing and then coming back in.
Why is that? Why is that particularly appeal to you?
Because it's nice when they see what I've done.
Okay.
Sometimes they don't.
Really?
No. Today they didn't really know what was happening. But that was still amusing to me because I knew where I was going.
Okay.
I knew that they'd get there eventually.
So do you, did you, am I right in thinking you sold out the run before you started the run?
Yeah. Can't believe it, really.
Why can you not believe it?
Well, because I'm not used to it. I'm much more comfortable if there's just a few of us in the room. That's what I feel most comfortable with.
Okay. So, but yeah, you obviously aware at the moment you are kind of in the ascendancy, would you say?
I wouldn't say that.
You're growing an audience, surely. You're... You've sold out your run before you started. Your audience is coming to see you.
Well, in Edinburgh.
Okay.
But I'm not sure what will happen on tour.
You don't think Edinburgh is sort of a benchmark for...
No, I think it's really different. And I also, because I've been coming here for 10 years as well, and it's like slowly built. But I think once you get out and about, well, we'll see. I'd be very surprised if they came.
Would you really?
I don't understand why there's
a huge amount of kind of column inches about you, and everyone's come and reviewed you, and it's. Do you know what I mean? It looks from the outside like it's really gathering momentum. Like what you do is really now, you know, being accepted and people are excited about it and buying tickets in advance.
Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't feel like that from inside.
Well, I think the perception of ourselves is much different to other people's perception of ourselves. I find it very hard to get you, because it's only been a year, really, that people have started coming and talking about and reviewing me. Mm-hmm. So I'm not used to that yet. In my mind, I'm still who I have been for the past 8-9 years.
Okay.
I don't see myself as any differently. That's why I'm surprised when sort of people come and people say, oh, people are, you know, writing about you. And I don't, nothing's changed for me the way I feel about myself. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So I'm constantly surprised all the time. I'm just, who are you, for example? Like, you've come to see Stu, you know. But it'll take a few years, I think, to get used, because it's only been a year.
Okay.
So it'll take a few more. I think it's too early to tell.
Okay. Okay.
So, for example, the last show did quite well at the Soho Theatre last year.
Mm-hmm.
So some people said, oh, well, maybe for your next one, you should maybe see if you do a bigger room and less nights. But I wasn't comfortable with that, because it's only 1 year. I think a year is too early to tell whether those people were... I didn't know whether they came because I had a good year or what. But I think maybe after another few years, then we'll be able to tell that it's not just a blip.
Sure. We're talking about people writing about you and that kind of critical mass and... I didn't mean that in a punning way, but lots of critics love what you do. You're getting great reviews. Do you read any of the reviews?
Not generally while I'm up here, but like people text you and stuff. I thought that I should come back straight away from last year, because I'm a stand-up anyway and a working stand-up, and that's what I want to do, and I want to tour, so I should come back anyway. But I did think that coming back the following year, that it might not be good for me in terms of what the press said, but I just thought I had to just get on with it.
How do you mean, in terms of
it took 10 years to find her voice and a year to lose it, you know, all that sort of thing. You know,
well, I mean, that when you say that sort of thing, that's not an actual quote that anyone said, that's you imagining what they would...
I mean, yes, I'm just thinking, yes, that's one of mine.
That's a very...
I put that on my own poster to preempt them.
But do you see what I mean? That's a very specific piece of kind of self-criticism of kind of...
No, but there's the narrative, you know, like journalists have, like we have, I think sometimes, I don't know, I thought that, you know, I mean, I did work really, really hard on this show, because then I thought at least they won't be able to say that I've not put the hours in, because I did, I mean, it really, but I thought that it might be. And also, I also knew that feminism probably wouldn't be that trendy again this year, which it isn't. Like, there's not been, has there been much talk about it? It's like, oh, 2013, the year feminism, but there's been nothing. So I thought they'd say, oh, that's really that year, she's doing this again, which I find quite amusing, actually.
Yes.
The idea
it's
that it would just be there for 1 year and then...
We've dealt with this now.
We've done that now.
Yeah.
So I thought that might be part of it as well. So a few people have said, oh, yeah, have you got you're doing what you've done, you know, it's fine this year. You've got away with it. You know, it's fine. And then, so I thought, well, let them say what they say, you know, because they will talk about the show last year because it won the award. And then if I could just get all that out of the way as quickly as possible and just move on. So next year, you know, it won't be relevant anymore. So, but I don't know what... But, yeah, I think it's been fine.
Okay. If you were to review yourself, what do you think, like, from an objective kind of point of view, what sort of things do you feel that you're... This is kind of what I was kind of grasping at earlier on about asking you satisfied with the show. Are there elements to your practice as a comedian that you feel like, I wish I was a bit better at that element of it, or...?
Yeah, all of it.
How can that be the case when you're doing so well and being so funny?
But that's your... That's...
But I've seen you be really, really funny to a big room full of people who were all laughing.
Well, you came on a good... You didn't come today. I don't know. It's not for me. It's difficult, isn't it?
Are you wary of not wanting to blow your own trumpet or something. I'd sort of, you seem hesitant or unwilling to entertain the notion that you might be good at stand-up comedy.
No, I think I'm getting better, but actually, really honestly, I think I only started to work out how to do it last year. I think I only really started properly doing stand-up last year. So to me, I've just started.
Okay.
That's how I feel in... I'm thinking about what I might be doing in sort of 10 or 15 years' time.
Okay.
I'm not thinking, get pretty bloody good, Chris. I'm not thinking that at all. Like, no, not at all. Not at all.
So what kind of principles then did you learn last year that you went, hang on, I think that might be onto something? Can you kind of...
Well, the first thing was, I suppose, confidence to say things that I thought and believed it. Whereas, because I did a lot of character stuff before and talked about things that... weren't my own opinions or that I thought were important or passionate about. So the having the confidence to be able to do that sort of freed me up a bit. Mm-hmm. So that might, you know, free me up to do other things in the future.
Okay.
You know, come at things from different angles or...
And do you have any... Do you feel like you have a kind of a toolkit of ways to attack a subject from lots of different angles?
I don't know. I think I'd like to do a show where I didn't speak at all. Well, I'm not going to do that yet because I've only just worked out how to speak.
Yeah.
I'm going to just chuck that in straight away. But it's so open, isn't it, stand-up? It can be anything. Like it can be anything at all. That's what I find really quite interesting and amazing about it. Is it can you can do anything with it. And that was the thing about getting rid of all the props and costumes when I was on tour. It's like, oh, I wonder if I just had a microphone, what can I do if I've just got a microphone? Like, what can I do with my voice and my body and my material? Can I replace all that other stuff with all this other stuff? And also having to write a radio series where it's all about the writing and how you say stuff and all of that, that made me think, oh... I should probably have been writing material before. you know, and then...
Okay.
Yeah, and also, I suppose, what can you... You can talk about anything, can't you? You shouldn't be afraid of subjects or anything like that. That's what I thought about with this show as well. There shouldn't be anything that you should shy away from. Is there a way to make those things accessible in this sort of an environment? And how do you do that? That's really interesting to me.
Just briefly, I mentioned we've been videoing a lot of these, and I always forget to ask my guests if they're okay with being videoed. And I asked you just before we started, and you said you're actually trying to remove, or you have removed, all trace of you from like YouTube, from public domain. And I just would be interested in where that comes from and what the thinking is behind that.
I really like the idea of that of me being like a live act that you come to see. I don't like the idea of me sort of split up into little... I don't know. I don't really want to exist on the internet.
Okay.
I don't like things of me. I like the idea of going around the country doing gigs and people seeing me live.
Yes.
I don't...
And do you feel that, like, the internet, that kind of just takes away the specialness of it, or it...
I don't think you can get a feel for what someone does if you see a little... I don't know. It's just what I would love for there not to be any, like, a photograph or anything of it, but that's not going to be possible. But, I just like that idea. I don't like loads of bits of me in different places out of context. And
that's quite unusual, do
is
you
it?
Think?
Is it?
Well, maybe it? Maybe yeah. Amongst comedians, it? Maybe it's maybe that
yeah,
maybe it's usual, but it's overridden by people wanting to be seen
or people wanting to market. Which is what people say. Well, you know, you might get more work if people could see what you did easily.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that I want a lot of work anyway. I've been trying to get out of not working. I would really like to not work. You know, I do enjoy it, but you know, just you know, I don't know. Is it weird? Is that weird then?
It's not weird, but it's a very specific choice. The only other comic I can think of who does something like that would have been Eddie Izzard, you know, 20 years ago when he said, "I'm not doing TV. If you want to see me live, you've got to come and see me live." Which no, I don't. I mean, I've not spoken to him about it, but maybe it's that was kind of a marketing strategy. But I've not really heard of anyone else kind of just kind of guarding their
video presence in that way. No, I mean, I've done TV. I mean, there's stuff of me on TV out mm-hmm. there. That's the stuff I've not been able to take down. Because they wouldn't let me. But I don't know. I just okay. don't like the idea of people watching me. I don't know. I think it's little bits and bobs all over the place I'm not that keen on.
Okay. We'll go to some audience questions just for the last couple of minutes before we wrap up. That was for newer comics trying to write about serious subjects. For example, how do you make FGM funny?
Well, you don't make the thing funny. You try and find a way to talk around the thing and make the thing around the thing funny. So with something like FGM, it's... Have you got... Are you involved in that subject? And can you put that subject... Can you displace it? So can you put it somewhere else? So, for example, the way I talk about it is I was making a short film to raise awareness for it, but the way that I got the money to make that was by going on ITV1 Celebrity Squares with Warwick Davis. So I talked about that experience, not actually about FGM. Mm. So you try and find ways, you put the subject into something else, basically, and try and talk around it. But I wouldn't have tried to talk about it, you know, when I was an open mind. But I wouldn't have known how to talk about stuff. But I don't think people should be put off from trying to talk about serious things. Just finding a way of doing it and having the confidence to talk about it as well. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Any others? What do you think about the competition within comedy for, e.g., TV spots?
I'm not aware of... I think we're all so different and individual that I don't see us as competing against each other. I don't see that at all. And the circuit is actually quite... There's a lot of camaraderie amongst us, and we're all sort of mates. We see each other at all. I'm not sure that we are competitive with... I think there's a place for everyone, isn't there? Do you think that we're all fighting for places on...
A little bit. I'm not a comedian at all, or a performer. As an outsider, I always thought there was sort of a sort of career ladder type.
There is, I think...
I'm not sure there's a sort of career... There's not a plan. Yeah, there may
there's
be
the illusion of a
one.
Career ladder, yeah. I think. And some people get very frustrated when it turns out to be an illusion or when they don't realise it's an illusion.
Yeah.
Because I think comedy starts you off kind of going, right, you're an open spot, and then you get a couple of quid to go on in the middle,
yeah.
And then you get a couple of quid to open, and then you get maybe paid decently to compare, and then you're headlining, and then just as you're headlining going, this is great, suddenly you get overtaken as if that's a thing, by someone who started more recently than you that now has a spot on a TV panel game. And I think it's easy for people, maybe more in the sort of club circuit that you wouldn't play so often.
Yeah, maybe there is that, but I don't know. I think there's a place for everybody, and I don't think you should try and have a sort of a game plan, because that's like it's just sort of like playing the lottery. I think you should just do what you want to do, and see what happens, and actually or do the opposite, try and be really unpopular and bad and not get any work. And see if that works, which is what I did. Don't tell anyone. No, it's not. Yeah, no. Just do what you do, I think, and not... Do you think we're competitive?
No, I don't think that we as a community are competitive, but I think there is competition within the community. There are certainly people I certainly know of, and they are in the minority, but I certainly know of comics who would kind of sneer and go, why haven't I got what that person's got? And I think that a lot of comics, you know, in the sort of in your most horrible, greasy little secret moments, you might go, oh, I wanted that and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I think that's
Yeah, maybe.
Fair.
There might be a few people thinking that today when they weren't on the shortlist. Maybe.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And you can't control things. The reason you shouldn't try and plan things and think about things like that is because you have absolutely no control over them whatsoever.
Mm.
So you can't... You've got to try not to be upset about things you can't control.
Mm.
And be upset about things that you do have control over, which is putting work into your own stuff.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can't control it.
Would you rather be trying to convert a crowd that were difficult and didn't agree with you, or getting the work done that you wanted to do in front of a crowd of people who were going for it and on side?
It's very satisfying if you're not doing very well. I enjoy all different types of gigs. I mean, you could be going down badly for all sorts of different reasons. I'm not trying to convince people to think the way that I think. I'm not saying think like me. I'm saying this is what I think about stuff. What do you think?
How many years was it before comedy became financially viable for you?
11. That's not unusual, is it? Why is that? Yeah, 11. It's just been the last year, really. Yeah. Yeah. Why did I keep going? Yeah. It's a lesson there.
What's the lesson?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, no, keep going. I don't know. But it's funny that I became financially... started making money when I thought that I wouldn't.
Mm.
When I thought I'd be really unpopular. So that is very interesting.
Mm.
When I did something that I thought wouldn't be financially viable.
Rather than trying to do what everyone else was doing, trying to... Well, not, maybe not everyone else, yeah. But rather than trying to please people and trying to appeal to people,
yeah.
Actually putting that to one side and going, no, well, you know...
This is it.
This is it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do what I want.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
That's all we've got time for. Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, Bridget Christie.
Thank you. Thanks.
So that was Bridget. Thank you so much to her for coming along. I really enjoyed that interview. I think that was a really measured and considered interview. I really appreciate I really appreciated Bridget opening up like that. And I really think it actually gives a lot of texture compared to other interviews we've had. Some people are very bubbly and effusive, and Bridget was much more measured and thoughtful in her responses. And I really appreciate that. And so many thanks to her for coming along. Thanks also, of course, to James Lowy, Pete Jones and Ben Lund Conlon for Podmin this time. And this episode was, of course, recorded live at Bob and Misbehave's bookshop under the Heroes of Fringe organisation at Edinburgh 2014 and was co-produced by Nathan Wood. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Next week, I think let's have Steen Raskopoulos. You're going to love Steen. Loads of fun. He got nominated for Newcomer about 90 minutes after we recorded this episode. Called it. So look forward to Steen next week and I'll speak to you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.